Hey, look, another big cable merger. What could possibly go wrong? Also, remind me, what's the first rule about Fight Club? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 26th of May. Great, as always, to have you along for the ride, everybody. So listen, you remember last month when the cable behemoth Comcast scrapped its $45 billion merger with Time Warner Cable? And you remember how Comcast was worried that the government wouldn't sign off on a deal that let Comcast rule the world, metaphorically speaking, of course? Well, here we are a month later, and instead of one cable and internet conglomerate, we are going to have two, count them, two. Charter Communications announced this morning it's going to pay $55 billion American dollars for Time Warner Cable and another $10 billion for a different cable provider called Bright House Networks. If the deal does make it past regulators, and the early betting is that it is gonna, the new company is going to have nearly 24 million customers, and we consumers will have been saved from a life of higher cable prices and fewer choices at the hands of one all-powerful company, because now there's going to be competition. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us started.
This deal reminds me of a charming childhood ditty. You can pick your nose, you can pick your friends, but you can't pick your friend's nose. In most places, your cable and broadband provider are like your friend's nose. No picking. And that's not going to change.
There's no competition coming to the market.
Amanda Lotz is a communication studies professor at the University of Michigan.
Most of this is, the impact of this is in behind-the-scenes type stuff.
Faster broadband, better set-top boxes. Jimmy Scheffler is the head of the media consulting firm The Carmel Group.
It gives this new company the breadth and the opportunity to take more risk, to spend more money, to invest more in new technology.
Tom Rutledge, the CEO of Charter, who's expected to keep that job, has reportedly discussed adding streaming services directly into cable. No input switching required. Just imagine not needing a doctorate to jump from Netflix to ABC to Hulu to the CW. A bigger cable company will also have more muscle.
Now this new company will be more aggressive, more eager to take chances.
To potentially push content providers to accept less money or maybe smaller cable bundles. Something else Charter CEO Rutledge says he wants. And that could reduce our bills, right? Not necessarily. They might just look different. Here's Amanda Lotz again.
Both of these companies are, like Comcast, in a great position. They are also the internet providers.
So we could end up paying a little less for cable TV and probably more for broadband. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
It is, for now, not raining in South Central Texas, but the past 36 or so hours there and across much of that state and north into Oklahoma have been devastating. Rescuers are still looking for the missing. Homes and businesses have been destroyed or damaged. Kelly's Baking Company in Austin, Texas, among them. Owner Kelly Moore was at her shop yesterday when the waters started to rise. Kelly, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Kai.
So tell me what happened.
Oh, goodness. Well, yesterday, the rain started and I was up here at the store working, painting the floors, and then the water just started rising.
Did you have product that got ruined? I mean, cupcakes and all that? Is it they're all soggy and gross?
Well, the back of our building actually sits lower than the front, so it had 2 feet of water in it, and that's where our walk-in cooler is. So everything in there will be thrown away, and we had a lot of storage in the back that we have to go through eventually and throw, you know, a lot of that stuff away.
Could you see it happening? I mean, the rain was coming down, and you could see the water level rising sort of in the back?
Yes, it was crazy. In the back of our building, we sit right on Shoal Creek, and when you actually go to the bank and look down, you can see the water, but yesterday it was at the bank and actually flooding out and flooding the street in front of us. But I looked in the back room. We have doors with windows on it, and I noticed the water was coming through the building, and then I was trying to, like, sop it up. But then it started coming through the kitchen and into the front of our showroom, and there was just no way to stop the water.
Who's doing the cleanup? Just you and maybe a couple of people, or do you have friends in there or what?
Yeah, well, last night my husband came over here, and we had to wade through the water to open all the doors, and it kind of rushed out. And then so we got all the standing water out last night, and then today one of my employees, Michelle, is here, and we're mopping up all the mud. So there's still a lot of cleaning. Once we go through and sanitize everything, it still has to be done again a couple of times. So we'll probably be closed for maybe a week.
Wow, really? That's a long time for a small business.
Yeah, well, we have countertops, so the water's underneath the countertop, so everything has to be moved and dried, and we still have to get some spray in here, so make sure there's no mold on the walls, and wash down the walk-in cooler, and there's still a lot of work to do.
Just you and your husband and a couple of people, or are there professionals you can call?
Yeah, I guess we could call it professionals, but we can do it. I'm pretty tough.
Well, good. Good luck, and we're thinking about you. Kelly Moore in Austin, Texas. She's the founder and owner of Kelly's Baking Company. Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Among the more reliable housing market indicators out there, and there are many that don't meet the bar, so caveat emptor, but among the good ones is something called the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And we learned when it came out this morning that home prices in 20 big American cities were up 5% in the year ended in March. 5% is better than a whole lot of economists expected and is all in all pretty good, especially when you throw in that the pace of new home sales, that is the number of sales, has picked up substantially. Thing is, a lot of younger people haven't been so keen to buy homes in this economy, so who is? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
Well, here's one person who recently bought a new, fairly inexpensive home.
My name is Tara Ilsley Murillo. I'm 28, and I live in Durham, North Carolina.
Economists the country over are happy for her, whether they know it or not, and not just because she is spending like one does on a new home.
My husband and I started a garden, and we put up a fence for our crazy dog.
But because Isley Murillo is part of this elusive group of 25 to 34-year-olds who have not been as present as they should be in the housing market.
The percentage of 25 to 34-year-olds with a job has increased.
Steve Blitz is chief economist at ITG. He says 25 to 34-year-olds in terms of employment have recovered about two-thirds of the drop they experienced in the recession. But that still leaves one-third to go.
Leaving that one-third out is one of the reasons why the level of home sales has recovered but not back to sort of pre-recession levels.
He says the 5% growth in sales may just be things getting back to normal after this past winter. And the rise in home prices, it's probably not about young first-time homeowners.
I think it means that there's some places in the country like San Francisco, Denver, and Dallas where there are not enough houses to buy right now.
That's David Blitzer, director of S&P Dow Jones Indices. They put out the Case-Shiller Index. Those places where home prices are rising, those aren't where the Tara Isley Murillos are buying. It's where they can't. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
About the only good thing you can say about the day on Wall Street today is that it's over. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of years ago, Amy Scott, our education correspondent, spent a full school year going in and out of Cincinnati, Ohio, working on a series about a school there called Euler School. Euler is part of a movement in education designed to help low-income kids actually finish high school and, fingers crossed, get out of poverty. It does that by surrounding those kids with the kind of support they often don't get at home, medical care and food and clothing and mentoring and college advising as well. This week, 45 seniors will walk across the stage and pick up their diplomas at Euler, where all of those services the school provides have helped, but the school is still in the bottom 5% of all the schools in Ohio. So, Amy went back not too long ago to check on things. Here you go.
Teachers, please excuse the interruption. The following students need to report to the cafeteria.
Sounds like somebody's in trouble, but keep listening.
For attendance and honor roll recognition. First student we have is Delmar Cento.
Awaiting Delmar and his fellow students in the cafeteria is a donut breakfast. It's a reward for getting high grades or missing no more than 2 days of school during the quarter. Step one in turning around a school like Euler, you got to get kids to show up. Children living in poverty get sick more often. They have to take care of brothers and sisters. Families move a lot or don't have reliable transportation. Sometimes a little nudge helps.
So come on up. You can have as many donuts as your stomach will allow.
That's Amy Randolph, principal at Euler. The state of Ohio has a minimum attendance requirement. And last year, Euler didn't meet it. So out came the donuts and gift cards to places like Chipotle and H&M.
Overall, school-wide, we have increased about 5% just in this past school year. So
you know, I think that that is an indicator that there's a little more motivation.
But it's going to take a lot more than donuts and gift cards to lift Euler out of the bottom 5% of schools in the state.
Help each other, help your partner.
It's also going to take higher scores on state tests. Math teacher Rachel Tapp has spent most of the spring semester getting her eighth graders ready for this year's exams.
Number five, I'm going to ask you to struggle around with that for a minute. I'm not going to help you yet.
After several years of progress, Euler has backslid in the last 2 years. And this year, Ohio switched over to new, by all accounts, harder tests aligned with the Common Core.
Oh, it was a lot harder.
When I visited, Justin Justice and his classmates were prepping for the second round of the new tests. They took round one back in February. Justin thinks he did pretty well.
It was like a couple questions I didn't understand. Besides that, yeah.
Still, Tapp, his teacher, says test scores can't capture everything Euler has achieved.
I agree that we need accountability, but I do wish that we had a better way of showing the work that actually gets done around here, because it is amazing and it does feel bad to fail over and over and over in the eyes of the state.
A lot of the work Tapp is referring to happens outside the classroom. Euler is built on the idea that before kids can learn, you have to meet their basic needs. In the last 10 years, the school has brought in a health clinic and vision center. It has a tutoring program with hundreds of volunteers, and now a dental clinic.
Open real big. That's a guy. Good job. Oh, that's perfect.
11th grader Bradley Daniels is reclined in a dental chair, mouth wide open, getting his first teeth cleaning in years. His mom, Tabitha Gribbins, sits by his side.
It's exciting to watch him grow, and college is next. I don't know, moving out and then moving on up in the world.
Not enough kids are taking that step, though. Today, Euler's high school graduates 40 to 50 kids every year. But Principal Amy Randolph says only about half of students who start as ninth graders finish in 4 years.
You should be graduating 95 to 100% of the kids that start. It's a small high school. It's designed for these students. So we're working on figuring out what can we do better to make sure we're doing that.
Randolph took over last year after the school's longtime principal resigned. With all the services in place, she can focus more on the academics. This year, the school got a three-year $1 million federal school improvement grant. Randolph hired instructional coaches to help teachers and launched a literacy program for the elementary grades.
There is a direct correlation with third grade reading levels and high school dropout rates.
In the high school, kids are taking their first advanced placement classes using new laptops they can bring home. And that's just inside the school.
How's it going?
With Euler, the job doesn't stop there. Part of its mission is to help revive a neighborhood plagued by drugs, prostitution, and poverty. After school, Randolph takes a walk through streets full of kids and neighbors enjoying a warm spring day.
This is really typical in the spring and the summer here. So, hey, buddy.
It was on a day like this last summer when a young man was shot here. In front of a small park, a tree is decorated with stuffed animals and flowers in his memory.
You know, it was real tragic because it was in the middle of a community cookout. So there was a lot of, it was like this, people everywhere. We had two-year-olds that, a kid in a diaper that actually, saw it. It was pretty horrific. So...
Still, there are signs of progress. There's a new pizza place and a community and art space run by a nonprofit ministry. One of the school's latest partnerships brought free Wi-Fi to the neighborhood. And Euler has started a new project, working with the city and local landlords and developers to create stable, affordable housing for its families.
Until we build and we have what we need, we're just going to keep working, keep chipping away.
That's a lot for a school to take on. But it's going to take a lot to create the kind of community where kids have little more to worry about than doing well in school. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy made a documentary film about Euler while she was there. It is called Euler. We've got an excerpt on our website along with pictures and the full radio series, which was called One School, One Year at Marketplace.org. Coming up.
They really hammered on me about creating Fight Club 2 as a graphic novel. So I had the time and I had the peer pressure. so what the hell?
He wrote it, so I guess it's okay if he talks about it. Chuck Palahniuk coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 190 points today, 1% close at 18,041. The NASDAQ dropped 56 points lower, also 1%, 5,032. The S&P 500 gave back 21 points also. Yeah, 1% ended things at 2104. Financial shares led the down home. March Bank of America off 1.5%. JP Morgan Chase declined more than 1%. Citigroup off 1.3%. The cable company consolidation we told you about earlier lifted both companies. Time Warner Cable buzzed up 7%. Charter Communications soared 2.5% higher. Elsewhere in the cable world, Comcast, Time Warner Cable's previous suitor, rose 1.25%. Bonds up as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Scripps National Spelling Bee continues. I love S-P-E-L-L-C-H-E-C-K. Feeling lucky? The annual World Series of Poker gets underway in Las Vegas. And how many blue boxes has Tiffany sold? The company releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how lobbyists get a bad rap? That they corrupt the political process and distort government and the economy and pretty much everything else? Well, yeah, right. But you know what else? Lobbying is a huge, ginormous business. There are 14,000 official lobbying groups in Washington, D.C., which does, I believe, make one wonder what they could all possibly be lobbying about. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer finds out with a business lunch.
I'm late, running through the rain to a lunch appointment with Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at New America who studies lobbying. He's waiting for me at the buffet.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, I am so sorry.
Oh, no.
Are you hungry?
I'm hungry enough.
We're here to see just how ubiquitous lobbying has become. We're zeroing in on the food business, loading up our plates, then dissecting them to see which foods have lobbyists at the table. We belly up to the buffet.
There's a watermelon association.
You want to get some watermelon?
Sure.
We sit down. Drutman pulls out a laptop with a list of lobbyists, and I tell him what's on my plate.
Oh, I'm going to take a bite of beef. Hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's a pretty big beef lobby.
Oh, there are 17 beef organizations here in Washington. We've got the Center for Beef Excellence, Agribeef, U.S. Premium Beef, Beef Products Incorporated.
You get the idea. Every single thing on our plates had somebody representing it on Capitol Hill. Sometimes lots of somebodies. For rice?
Oh, we've got 7 rice associations here.
Ditto for shrimp. Some of the trade associations are pretty obscure, like the International Natural Sausage Casing Association or the American Dehydrated Onion and Garlic Association. I reach for a bag of chips, which reminds me. I interviewed the CEO of the Snack Food Association, Tom Dempsey, because I was wondering, what are all these food folks lobbying for? Turns out it's stuff like labeling on packages and the federal government's new dietary guidelines. Dempsey says,
what the association does is tries to stay out in front of issues that may not impact the industry tomorrow, but will impact it down the line.
Other food lobbyists are focused on the new trade deals. There's one with Europe that's gotten the attention of the International Dairy Foods Association. Dave Carlin is the association's chief lobbyist. He says Europe wants to trademark the names of certain cheeses, but luckily,
the cheese will not stand alone.
Certainly, it's important to stand up for cheese, but there are 35 dairy lobby groups. I asked Carlin, why are there so many?
We have to tell our story, because if we don't tell our story, nobody else will.
There's an old saying in Washington, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Which brings me back to the buffet with Lee Drutman. We've started talking money. He says there are about 1,100 different food lobbying organizations in Washington, spending about $130 million a year. He says all the registered lobbyists in town spend about $3 billion a year. I wondered when lobbying got to be such a big business. Drutman says the food folks started around the time of FDR's New Deal, when a lot of agricultural subsidies were born.
It caused a lot of people in the agricultural industry to pay attention to politics.
Drutman says corporations started lobbying more in the 70s and 80s in the wake of increased government regulation, and it just kept growing. Now, lobbying kind of feeds on itself.
Once companies and associations set up shop in Washington, they rarely leave because they've hired lobbyists who can keep them interested in all the issues. And so once you start lobbying, you tend to keep lobbying, and there's a self-reinforcing stickiness.
Because you certainly don't want to be the one who's not at the table. Feeling full, but kind of like I want to wash my hands. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Even if you've never seen the movie, chances are you know the first rule of Fight Club. The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. That's a quote from Tyler Durden from the novel by Chuck Palahniuk, later popularized by Brad Pitt in the movie of the same name. The novel now has a sequel almost 20 years after it was published, but the sequel comes with a twist. It's a comic book or a graphic novel for the purists among you, written also by Chuck Palahniuk. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why have you decided, after all these years, to bring Tyler Durden back?
So many reasons. Number one, I finally had the time to learn a new storytelling skill. I had about a year off because my story collection was done. And I was invited, kind of ambushed at a dinner party, by a bunch of comic people, including Brian Bendis and Matt Fraction. And they really hammered on me about creating Fight Club 2 as a graphic novel. So I had the time, and I had the peer pressure, so what the hell?
I imagine it's a different mechanism for you to write. I guess you write to pictures instead of writing to your own imagination.
Writing to pictures and also not being able to depict action. There's so many different parts of that skill. As you see the two pages, the reader scans them all, so it gets a general idea of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
The only moment you can surprise or shock the reader is when they turn the page. It's called the page turn reveal. So you've got to have a setup at the bottom of the right-hand page, and you've got to have a payoff at the top of the left-hand page as they turn that page every time.
Wow, that's great. I hadn't even thought about it. I mean, of course, but I hadn't even thought about it.
And it drives you crazy to pace a story so artificially.
So, but you did it anyway.
I did it anyway because nothing could be more difficult than minimalism. And I wrote minimalism for years.
Yeah. Does it change, actually, how you as the author... Well, I guess you don't worry about the marketing and the sales, right? I mean, you do, but you don't.
You know, I've been really pulled into the whole creative, the whole enterprise. I have to answer the letter columns. I had to write 200 haikus as Tyler Durden. So those could be tweeted out gradually. And I had to kind of design a lot of the marketing things because this is supposed to be my baby. That's exciting.
What have the last 19, I guess, technically, years been like for you then since you wrote this book and had this movie that's become a classic?
You know, the biggest change, if I can be honest, is that both of my parents died. My father was killed in 99 and my mother died in 2009. And I had to come to terms with how much of my performance was based on pleasing them and getting their approval. And I had to find a way to motivate myself now that they were both gone.
But, you know, one of the things about the narrator in the original book and in the movie and a little bit, I guess, in the graphic novel, I mean, it's the first of 10 installments, is the sense of aloneness.
And that's very typical of my work, where a character achieves this isolation that thinks should be happiness. Because so many of us think that if we can get money enough, if we can kind of isolate ourselves in the country or in the penthouse, then we will be happy because we won't be dealing with Sartre's other people. And then once we do achieve that isolation, we realize we've never been more unhappy. So we're constantly swinging back and forth between isolation and community.
Yeah. Will there be, I am asking now on behalf of the legions of fans out there who are going to snap up this graphic novel, is there going to be a new movie?
You know, there's been interest. There's also been some television interest. So people are just kind of holding their breath right now.
Yeah, Fight Club on TV would be tricky. You'd have to go to cable, right?
You know, I can't say more than that.
Chuck Palahniuk, his new collection of short stories is called Make Something Up, Stories You Can't Unread. And there's also a new Fight Club graphic novel out. Chuck, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, which comes as an, I guess you might say, sorry, not sorry, for the aspersions I cast on millennials the other day. Maybe this will ring a bell. Ooh, millennials, gotta cater and market to the millennials. Told you that so I could tell you about this, which I saw on BuzzFeed today, an extension for Chrome, the web browser, that will replace the word millennials wherever it pops up online with the words snake people. I encourage you to try it. Here's one from the New York Times the other day. Fusion Media aims at snake people but struggles to find its identity. Works with the Washington Post, too. Snake people want a work-life balance. Their bosses just don't get why. Let's just say Wall Street today was lousy. I, for one, thought we were going to get the sad music, the wah-wah trombones, but whatevs. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.